I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the heart of the Middle East in the UAE, a member of the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, which meets in Rome today along with the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The food security summit will arguably be ironic given Guterres's behavior towards the UK-US-EU armed Gaza genocide and famine enabled and then paused by Donald Trump amidst a meeting in Egypt a week ago today. Some have better records than others when it comes to the genocide, where the worst human rights crimes of this century were committed. There were the journalists who were killed trying to tell us what was happening. There were those demonstrating against their NATO governments. And at the heart of what caused the genocide, there were officials in Tony Blinken's Genocide Joe State Department, like Josh Paul, Hal Ararat, Anel Shalain, Stacey Gilbert, Mike Casey, Harrison Mann, Tariq Habash, Lily Greenberg, Call, Alex Smith. At the UN that facilitated the UK-US-EU armed mass killing, the only one we could find was the director in the New York office of the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. He called it for what it was, a genocide. With more than 30 years' experience at the United Nations, Greg McIver resigned in 2023, and he joins me now from New York City. Greg, thank you so much for coming on Going Underground. Obviously, no one expected Trump, who publicly admitted in Egypt he was financed by Miriam Adelson, to use the word genocide. Why now, as your boss, your old boss, High Commissioner at the UN for Human Rights, Volker Türk, still not called it a genocide 2 years after you resigned and after you resigned after more than three decades there at the UN?
Hi, Afshin. Really good to be with you. Yeah, I think that's right. The High Commissioner for Human Rights, the Secretary General of the United Nations, even the UN's Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide have failed to call out the genocide for what it is after two full years. They have never mentioned the word genocide except to deflect the word apartheid. They've never addressed the root causes. And I think if you watch carefully their statements, you see that they prefer to take refuge behind the safe language of humanitarian aid, armed conflict, both sides, and this promise of some amorphous two-state solution somewhere down the road. This is simply fear. You know, this is a willingness to abandon the norms and standards of the UN, including its human rights principles, international law, and to abandon the people that they're pledged to serve out of fear of powerful Western states and out of fear of harassment from abusive Israeli proxy groups. But it's also a legal failure because there is a duty of prevention under the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. And you cannot, if you continuously defer to a court somewhere down the road, you cannot meet your obligations of prevention. And that's what they do, Afshin. You will hear them frequently say, well, only a court can determine genocide. You'll never hear them do that for other crimes, whether extrajudicial executions or torture or terrorism. They're always willing to use those phrases. But with genocide, because they fear powerful forces, they refuse to do so. And I think this is going to mean a high price that they all pay for their legacy. And indeed, you'll see now that many of their staff have risen up to object to this trepidatious approach on their part. They just seem to have been the wrong people at the wrong time in history to be dealing with this genocide.
Not that many staff. Yeah, the press in Dubai, Trump, I'll decide on one state or two for Middle East peace. So perhaps it's Trump anyway who decides whether it's a one state or two state solution. But anyone who thinks this is esoteric, I understand you've looked deeply, of course, into this. It might be particularly important for Antonio Guterres to use the G word genocide because of the UN General Assembly Uniting for Peace mechanism to override all those American vetoes under Genocide Joe and under Trump at the UN Security Council.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, parts of the UN have failed out of abdication. And in that, I would include the Secretary General, the High Commissioner, the Special Advisor, some other senior officials of the organization who have the power to speak out and take forms of action, but have chosen not to. Part of the failure of the UN has been by design, and that's where the Security Council comes in, where you have the permanent five members who have veto power. The US has repeatedly used that veto six times during the genocide, 50 times overall, in order to protect Israeli impunity, to prevent a ceasefire, and so on. But, you know, there are parts of the UN that have certain powers available that they have not yet opted to use. And you mentioned Uniting for Peace in the General Assembly. This is, a mechanism that was established in 1950 during the height of the Cold War because of the Korean conflict. and was used in 1956 to get around two veto-wielding members of the Permanent Five in the Security Council in order to mandate a UN emergency force to deploy to the Sinai at the height of the Suez crisis against the wishes of Israel, against the wishes of France and the United Kingdom. That mechanism still stands. And with each successive veto by the U.S., the General Assembly has had the power, based on the consent of the Palestinians, to adopt measures to deploy a protection force to Palestine and to adopt accountability measures for the Israeli regime, like sanctions and a military embargo and the denial of its UN credentials or the reactivation of the UN's anti-apartheid mechanisms. Any of these things could be done by the General Assembly despite the U.S. veto. There are efforts underway right now to make that happen. I think they've been slowed a bit by Trump's recent plan, which we will talk about. But Colombia in the lead and a number of other countries signing on based upon a movement in civil society, there is an effort to try to use Uniting for Peace to respond to the genocide in Palestine.
Well, I think the whole world will look forward to that. But when you mentioned the High Commissioner and Human Rights and Antonio Guterres, I mean, is there something on them? I mean, I remember when, why would they behave the way they do? You met them in the corridors there in New York. They don't seem like crazy genocidal maniacs. Kofi Annan, I remember, was bugged by British intelligence, according to a British cabinet minister some years back. There was a lot of shock about that. I remember Catherine Gunn, the whistleblower who's been on this show, who exposed the way the Iraq war votes at the UN Security Council were being corrupted by British and American intelligence. Do they have something on Guterres, the CIA, MI6?
Well, I don't know if they do. There's no doubt that intelligence agencies have used these kinds of pressure on United Nations officials. And by the way, the ICJ, which is is a UN court, has been subjected to these kind of pressures, just as the ICC has, the International Atomic Energy Agency, successive secretaries general. There's no doubt that that kind of pressure has been deployed.
But Dag Hammarskjöld died in an air crash.
Yeah, famously, and perhaps because he had been standing up to some of these powers with regard to the Congo. But I think in this case, what you're looking at is officials who are just, every time there's an election for a secretary general, the Americans like to quote themselves in saying that they want a secretary general who's more secretary and less general. In other words, they don't want a Dag Hammarskjöld. They want somebody who's going to go along and is going to defer to the most powerful states, especially the states of the West. And, these are people who owe their jobs. These are political appointees. They're not career
officials. But sorry to interrupt, but we might run out of time. What about the High Commissioner, then, for Human Rights, if we excuse Guterres, Secretary General?
I don't think we should excuse Guterres. I don't think we should excuse the High Commissioner for Human Rights. The High Commissioner, even more, he has a mandate directly from the member states, from the General Assembly. He has a specific mandate that says it's his job to speak out in order to defend human rights. He has hesitated to do so, again, as I say, out of fear of Western powers, and by the way, out of fear of harassment from Israel proxy groups.
But what are they going to do to him?
Well, nothing equivalent to what is done to the people of Gaza. What they'll do is they will demarche him, they will give him angry interventions, he will be smeared as an anti-Semite and a supporter of terrorism. We've all been through that, we've all been in that dance before, but that should not stop you from doing your job. And if you don't have the courage to do your job in the face of those sorts of interventions, my view is you should step down and let somebody do it who does have that courage.
I mean, presumably one of the best ones is corruption. I mean, every time we heard about kickbacks at the UN often, and we hear about corruption when it comes to people who are sometimes opposing U.S. hegemonic power at the UN. Is that the kind of thing? I mean, do the people watching this show have to watch out for when there are smears and attacks on people out of the blue who happen to oppose NATO policy?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it's not just smears. It's, you know, the United Nations, the various agencies and departments rely on funding from member states. And in the voluntary funding, most of that is coming from Western states like the EU and Germany and the United Kingdom and the United States and others. And, you know, they make their interventions very clear. You will go along with us or you will lose this funding. And I think that plays into it as well. But I want to say, Afshin, you know, there is a part of the UN that's been quite courageous. And if you look, for example, at the independent human rights mechanisms, like Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese, who has continued to do her job in a principled and courageous manner, despite the slurs and smears of the Israel lobby, despite threats, despite sanctions from the United States government, despite a lack of support sometimes from senior officials in the organization, she has not avoided telling the truth, applying the law, and doing her job. She, too, is a part of the United Nations. And I would point as well to UNRWA colleagues, you know, hundreds of whom have been murdered just in the last 2 years by the Israeli regime while they're doing their jobs, many along with their families. They should be the model that the Secretary General and the High Commissioner and others follow. If they don't have the courage to face a demarche or a cut in funding, look at what people like Francesca Albanese and the colleagues, UN colleagues and UNRWA have been doing, and take that lesson.
Which makes it all the more glaring that you're the only senior UN official to resign. You must have talked about it with colleagues before you made your decision. Why are you the only one?
I don't know. I can tell you there's a lot of disquiet in the organization. There has been throughout this entire 2 years. In fact, beyond this 2 years, 30 years of the Oslo ruse, where we were told that we should lower our voice when it comes to human rights in Palestine and that we should just defer to this U.S.-mediated process that only turned out to be a smokescreen and led to not just the further persecution of the Palestinian people, the further confiscation of their land, further settlement activity, the further normalization of the Israeli regime, all underwritten by a United Nations that had forgotten that its principal duty is actually normative. The protection of human rights, the advancement of economic and social development, the protection of peace and security, all of that was pushed aside for this amorphous political process. And there was a lot of frustration in the ranks during those years as people saw that the UN was abandoning its responsibilities during Oslo. But in the last 2 years of this genocide, there has been a virtual uprising from a lot of the staff. And that uprising has been, you know, repressed, I think, in quite an inappropriate way, so that a lot of people in the UN are afraid to speak out at this moment. My letter was in October of 2023, but my struggle with the UN started in the spring of 2023, when Israel was carrying out pogroms in the West Bank and persecuting Palestinians, strengthening the siege on Gaza, persecuting Palestinians across the land. And I was speaking out publicly on that, as I had done on dozens of countries all around the world for 32 years. But for the first time in my UN career, I was told by senior officials to shut up. And that was something I could not countenance. And so I announced to them early on that I would be leaving the organization. Of course, the situation only got worse between the spring and the fall of 2023, with a full accelerated genocide in Gaza and increasing persecution on the West Bank as well. And that's why I wrote that letter. So people were aware by October of 2023 inside the UN of what was going on. But senior officials were doing their best to make sure that the resistance was kept down.
Craig MacIver, I'll stop you there. More from the former UN human rights official after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former New York office director of the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, Craig MacIver. Craig, at the end of part one, you were talking about more than 30 years at the UN leading up to your resignation over the genocide. But of course, some people may be wondering or watching how you survived 30 years at the UN through the UK-US NATO bombing of Yugoslavia, the Obama-Libya destruction, the dirty war on Syria, the war in Iraq. Blair, of course, very much in the news now because he's been name-checked by Trump to run some sort of colonial regime over Gaza. Today is the anniversary of the capture of Gaddafi in Libya back in 2011. I mean, did none of those things make you want to resign? I mean, I know the genocide is the worst thing this century, but Did none of that want to make you want to resign?
Well, you know, I was privileged when I was at the UN because I spent my 3 decades plus in the human rights part of the organization, which is a part of the organization that is always in tension with the political side of the House. But if you look at what's happening there, and again, I'll hold out Francesca Albanese, but the other thematic rapporteurs, human rights mechanisms, human rights staff.
We've had many on this show.
Indeed. And you will see that the role that they play in the UN, which was my side of the house, is a role that is aligned with the norms and standards of the organization for human rights, for accountability, for international law, and so on. But that always has been in tension with the political side of the house, especially with the Office of the Secretary General, political affairs, and other parts of the system. So I was relatively sheltered, although often doing battle with that side of the house. But nevertheless, the frustrations are not something that started just with this genocide. This was a peak. Remember that the UN has dropped the ball more than once on opposing genocide in Rwanda.
Yeah,
in,
but I'm not talking Bosnia. So much as dropping the ball. I'm talking about human rights as a weapon. I interviewed someone from the CIA-backed Uyghur agencies trying to make out there was a genocide. And of course, there was no genocide in China. Despite all the attempts to be able to persuade NATO nation media that there was. The weaponization of human rights, you saw it from inside. Give us some examples of how you saw the weaponization of human rights from the inside, because clearly it has been during your 30 years.
Well, there's no question that states like the United States have always weaponized human rights and have tried to use United Nations mechanisms in their efforts to do so. There's no question about that. And sometimes the UN has fallen into that trap. Certain parts of the UN have fallen into that trap. I think for the most part, you will see that the independent part of the human rights system has challenged that approach. But, you know, as I say, the political offices, look, even during this genocide, we saw people on the Secretary General's side of the House repeating Israeli propaganda for genocide that was false. And that was the kind of accusations, you know, the 40 dead babies, the systematic campaign of rape, things like hospitals under Hamas centers under hospitals.
The rape situation was particularly egregious because the UN played such a part.
Not just because it is false, but because there is a reason that that lie was created by Israel. It was fabricated in order to create space for genocide. And repeating that lie is a form of complicity in the genocide, especially if you haven't done your due diligence to make sure that the talking points coming from Tel Aviv are actually true and not a part of the propaganda of genocide. That's an extremely dangerous thing to do. And it's not just, as I say, an effort to sort of, you know, soften your relationship with the Israelis by repeating their talking points. It is complicity in genocide, because without that kind of propaganda, the Western support for the genocide over 2 years could not have been sustained. And the UN should never, ever play into those kinds of traps.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Blair, as I said, is back in the news because of Trump name-checking him. I mean, I want to ask you, what do you think of that? But also, you were deputy director of the New York office of the UN's Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights in 2003. What did you think about Blair then, when he was spinning the lies about Iraq? Britain, of course, a big funder of Saddam Hussein before it turned against him.
Well, I mean, this whole Gaza peace plan, so-called, and of course it's not a peace plan, is just a kind of party between war criminals like Tony Blair and Donald Trump and others. And I think that's part of the reason that it has no legitimacy. I mean, to be clear, Afshin, this is not a peace plan. It's not a plan for ending the so-called Israel-Palestine conflict. It contains no promise of Palestinian liberation, no restoration of the rights of the Palestinian people, no guarantee of Palestinian statehood or self-determination. And where it does mention the idea of some political solution, it is this hyper-qualified reference to, you know, conditions that may emerge sometime in the future if Gaza redevelops the way they want it to, if the PA reforms to the satisfaction of its U.S. imperial overlords. And in the wake of a genocide perpetrated by an apartheid regime, it doesn't mention genocide, it doesn't mention apartheid, no accountability for perpetrators, no redress for the victims, no reference to international law. And in fact, I need to say this, Afshin, the plan, in fact, in some provisions, actually violates international law because it conditions humanitarian aid on certain political conditions. It contains implicit threats of collective punishment if Hamas doesn't agree to something. It explicitly denies Palestinian self-determination, which is the highest rules of international law. It contains restrictions on political rights for some Palestinians, a requirement that Palestinians negotiate for their human rights with their oppressors, and it seeks no accountability for Israeli crimes, including genocide, which are breaches of international law, including...
Yeah, isn't the point that no one cares about international law now? Karim Khan, head of the International Criminal Court, has been on this show. And didn't that start, you were at the UN, with the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia? Because that was the start of the end of international law, which makes it look all the more ridiculous that Putin is being summoned by the International Criminal Court over what the Russians would say is much less than what Britain and the United States and European powers did as regards Yugoslavia. Wasn't that the beginning of the end?
I think that was a blatant breach of international law, but those blatant breaches of international law go back even further. And, you know, indeed, with regard to Palestine, for example, you can trace the roots of this back to 1948. 1948 was the year that the Universal Declaration was adopted. It was the year that the Genocide Convention was adopted, but it was also the year of the Nakba, the destruction of Palestine and the creation of the Israeli state, and the year, by the way, of the beginning of apartheid in South Africa. So what you saw was, even as these international rules were being developed, certain exceptions were being carved out for priorities of Western colonialism. And Israel has been able to maintain that exceptional status guaranteed by the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and others for, you know, 80 plus years. And now we've seen just how far that exceptionalism would go, where we're told that we have to accept even genocide perpetrated before our very eyes over a two-year period, and that there can be no accountability for the perpetrators. So that is how far that Western-guaranteed exceptionalism for Israel has gone. And I think there are a lot of people who are pushing back against this. I think international law itself is as much on trial as is the Israeli regime. And we will see in very short order whether international law, a relatively nascent project, right, in the history of the world, whether it will survive much longer. And, you know, the jury is out on that.
Yeah, a great supporter of the genocide won the Nobel Peace Prize. What's her name? Machado, Maria Corina Machado. How can we explain when we see human rights abuses, alleged abuses, in the NATO nation press? This is the New York Times. How should we read it? Is it basically human rights weaponized for regime change? We won't hear about the fact that life expectancy in the United States is 71.9 in Mississippi and illiteracy in California is 44%. We'll hear human rights abuses always in countries that the United States wants to overthrow.
Absolutely. This is clearly the abuse of human rights. It's often an afterthought that is tacked on to other justifications of war. It's often an extension of the demonization of other populations in order to till the ground for military activity, you know, in Western popular opinion. And you mentioned Western media corporations. They are part and parcel. They are a part of that endeavor. They have never seen a war that they didn't like. War is money for them. Indeed, you know, I think you can say that, you know, that war is a business for the U.S. empire, right? For the U.S. empire, for corrupted members of Congress, for the presidential administration, the lobbies, the Beltway bandit consultancies that surround Washington, the tech companies of Silicon Valley, the weapons manufacturers, the military industrial complex that effectively governs Washington. For all of them, war is a business. And indeed, it is the principal source of revenue for the U.S. empire. And I think nowhere is that more clear than when you see, with the complicity of Western media corporations, the cycle of demonization that precedes any military activity, where there is a concentrated effort coordinated between government and media corporations to make populations in the West hate and fear a particular group. You know, we saw this with Iran and Iraq and Syria and Libya and Palestine and Russia, and now, you know, increasingly with China, that this is the tilling of the ground for military aggression.
Just finally on that, it's amazing that you survived 30 years at the UN, believing all that you say here. Is it clear to you that war with Iran is next, then China? I'm not sure whether you think the genocide would have been possible without the destruction of the Assad government in Damascus. Is Iran next?
I think, you know, even now the Israeli regime and its partners among Washington elites, you don't know where Donald Trump stands, but, you know, the core of Washington elites together with the Israelis are gearing up for war with Iran. And I think the Israelis in particular are looking to use the pause on military activity in Gaza for as long as it lasts to try to turn its forces toward Iran. Netanyahu has repeatedly threatened to do so. And I think by now people should learn that when Netanyahu threatens to do something, he is going to do it. This, after all, is a regime that is drunk on impunity. It is a regime that is occupying territory in Lebanon, in Syria, in Palestine. It is a regime that carried out a transnational terror attack in Lebanon with booby-trapped pagers. It is a regime that has carried out aggression against half a dozen countries in the Middle East. It is a regime that has bombed humanitarians in the Mediterranean Sea. It is a regime that has perpetrated a genocide where it declared openly what it was doing and then carried that out on the ground. And now, drunk on that impunity granted to it by the U.S. and other Western and regional collaborators, and knowing that he got away with a genocide literally so far, he now sees his chance. So the risk of further Israeli aggression on Iran is extremely high, in my view.
Greg McIver, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US EU armed genocide in Palestine. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new episode. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.